Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington.
And I'm Anna Mateo. On today's As It Is, we talk about the environment and how environmental issues are affecting the health of people around the world.
In the second half of the show, we will talk about the effects of air pollution in Asia. But first, we hear about a recent meeting in Washington, D.C., between health and medical experts.
The meeting was held a day after the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released a report on climate change. The report deals with health and economic reasons for lowering gas emissions into the atmosphere. Emissions such as carbon dioxide gas from cars or factories are linked to rising temperatures.
The findings are similar to those of an independent research group, the Lancet Commission on Health and Climate.
Now, Pete Musto brings us more on this story.
The Lancet Commission report says the effects of climate change could threaten the past 50 years of gains in public health. Commission project leader Nicholas Watts says the changes in Earth's climate have led to weather extremes. The extremes can create public health risks that he considers very dangerous and unacceptable. Mr. Watts says the changes have led to less rainfall, and this has been linked to a drop in agricultural productivity. The reduced productivity has led, in turn, to an increase in malnutrition, especially among children. Studies have linked climate change to an increased likelihood of flooding in some areas. Mr. Watts says floods are linked to a rise in the rates of infectious diseases, cholera, and problems that result from a breakdown of waste treatment systems. He also notes that the world is getting hotter. In 2003, 70,000 people in Europe died because of higher than normal temperatures. The World Health Organization has warned that serious action is required to reduce global warming emissions. If the reduction does not happen, the WHO says, there will be serious results. By 2030, almost 250,000 people will die every year from the effects of global warming. The Lancet Commission suggests several ways to deal with climate change. They include closing coal power plants, increasing the use of renewable energy, investing in health systems, and agreeing to support a global climate treaty. World leaders are expected to meet in Paris in December to sign that measure. Mr. Watts says that politics and complex issues will be debated. But no matter what, he says, the treaty is about public health. Mr. Watts hopes the Commission's report helps unite healthcare experts behind a global treaty. He hopes that the treaty can respond to the risks of climate change. What is good for the planet, he adds, is good for patient care. I'm Pete Musto.
I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. You are listening to As It Is.
Thank you.
Welcome back to As It Is. We just heard a report about how climate change is affecting the health and safety of people around the world. Now, we move to a specific area of the world, Asia. A new report says cleaning up polluted air could prevent up to 2.1 million premature deaths every year. Premature death means to die too soon. Here is Ana Mateo with more on this story.
Air pollution is the biggest environmental health risk in the world, says the World Health Organization. Part of the problem is particulate matter, very small particles floating in the air. Particulate matter, also known as PM, may get trapped in the lungs. Scientists have long known about the harmful effects of breathing PM. The particulates are linked to an increased risk of breathing problems, heart attacks, strokes, and lung cancer. In 2005, the World Health Organization proposed air quality guidelines and limits for some air pollutants that raise health risks. Its guidance showed that by reducing PM levels from 70 to 20 micrograms per cubic meter, we can cut air pollution-related deaths by 15%. A U.S.-based team has been studying the issue. Its members are environmental engineers and public health researchers. The team recently prepared a model to show how much people would be helped if air pollution from PM is cut to the WHO's suggested limits. Joshua Opte is an assistant professor of environmental engineering at the University of Texas, Austin. He led the study. The study estimates that reducing air pollution around the world could save 1.4 million people in places like India and China. But that is not an easy goal. India and China are home to some of the world's most polluted cities. 13 of the world's 20 most polluted cities are in India. The capital, New Delhi, is at the top of the list. The study also shows that even if the pollution levels stay the same, death rates would jump by over 20% in India and China. Joshua Opte explains that the main reason for this increase is population changes in these countries over time. He notes that as the population gets older over time, the number of people at risk of heart attack or stroke goes up. But it may be difficult for India and China to improve air quality, since both countries still use coal for electricity. Many roads are becoming filled with vehicles owned by the growing middle class. China has done some work in cleaning the air, but experts believe that air pollution could worsen in India. They worry that India wants to increase the number of coal-powered plants to fuel the country's economy. Researchers found that places with cleaner air, such as North America and Europe, could save up to 500,000 people a year if they met the WHO's air quality guidelines. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. Tune in tomorrow for another As It Is. And don't go away. Coming up next are words and their stories and people in America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Now the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. It has happened to all of us. You want to talk about an object, but you forgot the name of it. Or you never knew the name at all. Maybe you are not even sure there is a word for it. For example, that thing that you need to fix your bicycle. Or perhaps it is something you need for your computer. Or that part on your motorcycle that never ever seems to work. What are these things? They are called doohickeys. A doohickey is a word you use when you do not know or you have forgotten the real name of an object. The Macmillan Dictionary defines doohickey as something such as a small object or tool that you cannot remember the name of. The American Heritage Dictionary says it is something, especially a small device or part, whose name is unknown or forgotten. Language experts say the word first started being used in the United States in the early 1900s. But other experts say they have seen examples of words like these in writings from the middle 1800s. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary for Learners of American English gives this example of how native speakers might use doohickey. I need one of those doohickeys, you know, with the long handle. Merriam-Webster adds that doohickey may be a combination of two other words, doodad and hickey. Strange as it may be, both of these words mean the same as doohickey. The dictionary lists a lot of strange words as synonyms for doohickey. The most common are whatchamacallit, whatnot, and what's it. You will probably never see these words in official documents or newspaper reports, but you might hear them in informal American English when people are talking to each other. Hey, what does this doohickey do anyway? Dude, bring me that thingamajig, will ya? Janine, can you get me one of those, whatchamacallits? Most Americans will know what you are talking about if you use one of those words. Just point at the object, use one of these words, and they will bring it to you. Doohickey and words like it have their own page on the Wikipedia website. Wikipedia calls them placeholders. It says words like these are usually nouns and can be used for people, objects, and places. Unofficial studies show Americans are using words like doohickey less than they once did. The decline seems to have started a few years ago. Still, a recent search of Google News showed the word was used in more than 1,000 news articles in just a couple months. One story told about a store where you can buy a cable that connects a thingamajig to a doohickey. Another told about a doohickey for eggs, and even a doohickey that connects to a camera. Workers who repair Kawasaki motorcycles use the word doohickey to describe the vehicle's counterbalancing chain adjustment mechanism. You can see a video of them using the word on YouTube. I'm Anna Mateo. This Words and Their Stories was written by Christopher Jones Cruz. And now for words in this story. Motorcycle, noun, a vehicle with two wheels that is powered by a motor and that can carry one or two people. Synonym, noun, a word that has the same meaning as another word in the same language. Handle, noun, a part of something that is designed to be held by your hand. Informal, adjective, not formal, such as having a friendly and relaxed quality. Cable, noun, a strong rope made of wires that are twisted together. Does your language have words for things for which you don't know the name? We'd like to know what they are. Tell us about them in the comments section.
I broke the doohickey off of her thingamajig last night.
People in America, a program in special English by the Voice of America. Each week at this time, we bring you a story about people who were important in the history of the United States. Today, Doug Johnson and Larry West begin the story of Stephen Vincent Benet. He was one of the most popular American writers of the first part of the 1900s.
A young woman once asked Stephen Vincent Benet for his advice on writing. This is what he said. I spent my childhood on a series of army bases. If I were writing stories about that, I would have to explain a few things about the army. I would have to give you a sense of being in a world of your own that children have. I would have to show you that it is as natural for an army child to move to a different base every few years as for a civilian child to grow up in one town. It was natural for Benet to talk about writing and his childhood at the same time, for his family and early surroundings shaped his life as a writer, perhaps more than usual.
Stephen Vincent Benet was born in 1898 in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He was named in memory of his grandfather, who had been a general in the United States Army. General Benet attended the Military Academy at West Point and was an expert on military law. He served in the Army before, during, and after the Civil War. Stephen's father also was an Army officer. Colonel James Benet worked on questions of military supply and artillery. Stephen was born while his father was on duty at the Bethlehem, Pennsylvania iron factory.
Stephen Vincent Benet was born into a world of history, poetry, and laughter. His parents loved to read. So did his brother and sister, who were much older than he. The Benet house was filled with books. Stephen's mother and brother wrote poems. His sister supervised his studies. And his father talked to him about history, philosophy, and literature. Colonel Benet always could find a kind word to say or a joke to tell. Many years later, Stephen wrote, "My father was interested in everything, and he was the finest critic of poetry I have ever known. He taught me many things about writing, and understanding of others, and independence, and the desire to know things."
Stephen's childhood was almost completely happy. He had suffered an illness when he was very young, and this left him with a weak heart. But he played tennis and football and loved to take long walks. His family members were his team players and close friends. Colonel Benet earned enough money to provide the family with everything they needed. By the time Stephen was 8 years old, his brother and sister were studying at universities. They introduced Stephen to their friends, some of whom would become famous writers and artists. These young people took an interest in Stephen, for he was an intelligent boy who spoke well. they began to send him things to read, books, and some of their own writings.
Colonel Bonnet's work took him to different places. So, while Stephen was still a boy, he lived in the states of Pennsylvania, New York, California, and Georgia. He was happy to be able to see some of the places he had read about, places that were famous in American history. In the West, there were the mountains, rivers, and towns with Spanish names. In the North and South, there were the battlefields of the Civil War.
Stephen especially liked the army base in Georgia, where he and his parents lived. The base was almost 200 years old. All around the buildings, inside and out, were the cannons and other equipment of past battles. Best of all, Stephen was able to visit the great farms and small towns where little had changed since the Civil War had ended in 1865. He listened to the talk of old Southern women who remembered very clearly the years before the war. More than 40 years had passed, but the old women and the others made the past come alive for the boy. He thought about writing history.
By the time Stephen was 15, he was writing almost every day. The summer before he entered Yale University, at the age of 17, he published his first book of poems. The poems were political and philosophical. They expressed his thoughts on democracy and freedom. At Yale, Stephen made loyal friends. He was truly interested in people. He was a quiet young man with little color in his face. He wore round eyeglasses and did not care much about his clothing. His friends tried to improve his appearance, and they tried to show him things that interested wealthy young men at that time. But Stephen liked simple things and did not change.
Stephen worked hard at the university. He became editor of the Yale Literary Magazine, which the students published. The literary magazine was popular with students and writers at other schools, too. Stephen wrote poems and articles for the magazine and for a number of other publications. He did this in addition to his schoolwork. Stephen learned to write very quickly. Often he would write while attending classes or sitting in noisy coffee houses. This method did not always produce the best writing, but it made it possible for Stephen to produce a great deal of writing. Before he finished his 4 years of study at Yale, many people had read his poems and stories.
Stephen was almost 21 years old when he left Yale. He no longer wanted to take money from his father, who would soon retire with a wife and daughter to support. Stephen's brother, William, was a successful writer and editor. Yet he did not earn much money. So Stephen went to New York City. In the next 2 years, he worked briefly in an office. Then he returned to Yale. The university helped him win an award of money to travel and write. The money gave him the chance to write whatever he wanted, wherever he wanted. Stephen decided to go to Paris.
In those years, the early 1920s, many young American writers lived in Paris. Among them were Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Stephen fell in love with the city and with an American woman he met there. The woman was Rosemary Carr. She was a writer for a newspaper in the American city of Chicago. Stephen and Rosemary returned to Chicago to be married. The Benets decided to make their home in New York. Stephen had written 2 books and a great many poems when he was in Paris. He would spend the next 5 years writing stories for popular magazines. The stories were not about serious people or ideas. They were stories of the moment, not meant to be remembered.
Stephen often took long walks through the streets of New York. He did not like the life he saw there. He did not like the politics. He did not like the methods people used to succeed. And he did not like what he saw in many of the people's faces, a sense of hopelessness and need. Stephen began to think back to his childhood, to the way he saw America as a boy. He thought about the history of America and about its heroes. He decided to stop writing foolish things. He wanted to use his stories and poems to show Americans what was good and valuable in their culture. He wanted to give them something to believe in.
You have been listening to the special English program, People in America. Your narrators were Doug Johnson and Larry West. Our program was written by Barbara Dash. The Voice of America invites you to listen again next week at this same time when we will complete our story of the life of writer Stephen Vincent Benet. For VOA Special English, this is Shirley Griffith.